Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, the comedians that perform here, and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what helps make up our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Dawn Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. I'm so excited to introduce you to founder and director of Digital Minerva, James Carter. James is originally from the historical city of Bath, England. His company, Digital Minerva, is a full-service digital agency. They have proven expertise in business online presence, websites, photography, video, marketing, hosting, digital reputation management, SEO, and digital advertisement, serving a wide range of businesses from local mom-and-pop shops to international organizations. James began his journey in an online business when he built an e-commerce website selling baby products to fund his family's move from England to Virginia in 2005. That venture kicked off a love for marketing that would eventually lead to the opening of his full-service marketing agency. He honed his digital marketing skills while serving as webmaster for James Madison University, and he's always trying to learn and keep up with new digital trends. He's all about that collaborative nature of this friendly city and is so very proud to call the Shenandoah Valley his home. Welcome to the show, James. It's great to have you on today.
Thanks, Dawn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, I'm so excited. You're one of my favorite people here in the friendly city, and you are the first person I've met here that is from England, and I've never been there yet, though it's on my bucket list. So I'd like to start with learning a little bit more about where you are from. So do tell, what is Bath, or what is it like to be from Bath, England? What do you love most about where you're from?
So Bath is a relatively small city in the southwest of England. It was originally founded about 2,000 years ago by the Romans, and they discovered hot springs there, and they discovered the therapeutic natures of the water, and so they built the Roman baths, which still stand today. And so the original Roman settlement has obviously been built on over hundreds of years, and the majority of the current city is Georgian, and there is a huge amount of beautiful architecture. The Royal Crescent is there. And you have a very wide diversity of attractions there for tourists. It's a very popular tourist destination, especially for American tourists. We often joke that the Americans get to London, take a bus to Bath, spend 4 hours traveling around on a bus, and then go back to London.
Not really taking in much of the sights then that way, are they? So they're missing out.
No, but It's in terms of size, it's probably about the geographical size of Harrisonburg, but because it's so densely populated, last time I checked, there was 90,000 people there. So it's a city, it's a World Heritage Site. There's a lot of culture there, a lot of arts. It's a really, really sort of an overgrown village, is what my friend's dad used to say.
What would you recommend people go and see for sure? Get off that bus and take some time to really look around Bath. If I went, for example, what would you say? Dawn, you must go see this. You must go do this in Bath, England. What would you recommend?
So number one on the list has got to be the Roman baths. And you can also taste the water, which has obviously been filtered, because it would be absolutely terrible for you to drink it otherwise. It's warm, so most, you know, it's a bit different to the American palate for water, but you can absolutely drink that. And so a lot of the Roman architecture is still there. You can walk around the baths, and just across the courtyard from that is the Abbey, where I believe the first King of England was crowned. And ultimately, I would recommend that a lot of people will then take a trip to Stonehenge, and then be slightly disappointed because you can't actually touch any of the stones there and you have to walk around from a distance. But actually, if you head down the road a little bit to Avebury, there are pubs that have beer gardens with stones of a pretty similar age just in the beer gardens next to the picnic tables. So you can actually, you know, experience hands-on, but also check off the list that you've been to Stonehenge as well, because that's really not very far away.
Okay. What was the name of the city you said that was not far away?
Avebury.
How do you spell that?
A-V-E-B-U-R-Y.
Oh, thank you. That helps so much. Yes, thank you for that. And now that you're here in America, away, so far away from home, what do you miss the most about home in Bath, England?
Undoubtedly, my family, first and foremost. While I have relatives in America, we're spread out around the country. My grandfather's sister moved over here just after the war to New York and fell in love with a fellow professor. And they then spent the rest of their years over here and eventually moved to Sewanee. But I have relatives out on the West Coast and scattered across the East Coast as well. But ultimately, my immediate family is still in the UK. So that would be the main thing. I do miss being able to sort of pop into town and go and watch a play last minute at the Theatre Royal and pay just £10 for a last minute ticket. I certainly miss the public transit over there, being able to not need a car, take a bus, take a train to Paris as a day trip, you know, those sorts of things. And affordable flights as well. You know, you can get to Ireland for £30 or £40. So, you know, the infrastructure is very different, but it's been around for a lot longer.
That's true. Now, you have been spitting out some money terminology there that us Americans, so a lot of us, I don't think, are really completely knowledgeable about, I would say. So I don't personally know or have a reference to what a pound is to a dollar. So when you say 10 pounds, I mean, it sounds like the way you're talking about it, it's a steal of a deal, but I don't have any reference to really know what that means exactly. So what is the dollar transfer from a pound to a dollar? So what would 10 pounds be in American dollars, for example?
Yeah, well, we can thank the disastrous last few years of removing the UK from the European Union for making this as simple as possible, because now we're pretty much back to one and one. Okay. So 10 pounds is about $10, $11, $12. Not really much difference.
Okay.
So it's varied a lot in the time that I've been here. Usually against my favor for sending money to the UK. But ultimately now we're pretty much a like for like.
Oh, okay. So that is amazing deal right there. So basically roughly a $10 show at the last minute, which is amazing. And then getting a flight for approximately $30 or $40. Yeah, I would miss that too. I would definitely miss that. I think, too, I want to talk about how you built an online business selling baby products to fund your family's move here to Virginia. I find that so interesting. And I want to know, why did you choose to sell baby products, of all things, for your first online business?
So it happened when we were expecting my second child. And at the time, their mother was visiting the US, visiting family, and she had become a little concerned that she hadn't felt anything for a little bit of time. So she went to a store and got a prenatal heart listener, and that enabled her to hear kicks, heartbeats, that kind of thing. It's basically an amplified microphone. And she brought that back to the UK, and we noticed that that really wasn't on sale in the UK. So what we actually started doing was purchasing directly from the manufacturer in New York, shipping it to family in Virginia, and then shipping it overseas to the UK. And we started selling those on eBay, and they sold like hotcakes. And ultimately then, we worked with a web development agency to build out what became parentbaby.com. And that then expanded to selling safety gates, houses, strollers, pretty much anything that a parent would need. And we used our experience as new parents to sort of put the products that we were looking for online and sell them at, you know, a reasonable price. And ultimately, you know, from beginning to end, it was probably, I'd say, about a year and a half by the time we'd sort of saved up enough money to help fund our move to the United States. And we packed up 15 boxes of stuff, chucked it in the belly of an airplane, and flew over to the States.
Just 15 boxes? You really, I mean, in the grand scheme of a big move like that, that's not a lot, is it?
Well, you can't bring a dishwasher because it doesn't run on the same electrical voltage, and you're probably going to pay a lot in shipping.
All right.
But yeah, we literally moved over here, didn't have a job, didn't have a house. We spent 2 weeks in a hotel. I interviewed and eventually got my first job in the States, bought a car, found a townhouse to rent. And, you know, within a month, we'd started our life over here.
That's really great. Now, that year and a half, the goal to make the move over here, was that the idea that it would take about a year and a half? In other words, was this quicker or longer than you expected to make that goal to make the move to the U.S.?
Really, the holdup was with paperwork and getting my visa. It's not easy becoming a permanent resident alien of the United States. So ultimately, you know, countless interviews, different types of paperwork, background checks from the police force in the UK, and then various law enforcement agencies over here, interviews, vaccinations that Americans don't have to have, and full-on medical as well to make sure that, you know, everything's okay. And that's, you know, that's what you have to go through to get over here. So I'd say ultimately, the thing that took that long was all the paperwork, my permission to be able to work over here. And that's the key thing, is getting that green card to be able to have a job and to pay taxes.
Mm. Do you have to get the green card first before you can get a job, or do you get a job and that helps you get the green card?
No, you have to have the authorization to work in the United States before you can actually start a job. And you know, you have E-Verify to make sure people are eligible to work. If you don't have a social security number, there's nothing to apply to that. So ultimately, your alien number is the gateway to be able to be a taxpaying member of society, although you don't get any of the benefits like voting in your local elections or federal elections or anything like that. You just pay your taxes. It's like being Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Wow, that's pretty amazing. So your alien number, which is an interesting term to use, by the way, but the alien number functions as sort of a social security number or identification number is what I'm understanding.
Well, you have to have a social security anyway, but
okay.
Your alien number is your permanent resident authorization number. So that then enables you to stay in the U.S. and you renew that every 10 years and you have to go for an appointment and show that, you know, you're not a bad member of society, you know, you haven't committed any crimes and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's nerve-wracking. Once every 10 years, you're thinking, you're hoping that you're going to be approved for renewal, and, you know, you never know if you're going to have to leave this life that you've worked so hard on.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's would be a bit challenging and unsettling, you know, process.
So becoming a citizen adds so much more stability to your life and means that you can really, you know, carry on to plan out so many things in your life that you're uncertain about or you're worried that you may eventually lose. So, you know, you can, that decision is outside of your hands. Obviously, once you become a citizen, there's no turning back. And now I've voted in every election that I've been able to, and you know I take great pride in that aspect of being a U.S. citizen.
Was that a lengthy process to become a U.S. citizen, and how long ago was that for you?
I was hoping to become a citizen in July of last year. and actually it was bumped another month. Actually, I just realized I've been a citizen for more than a year. It was a year and a bit ago.
Okay. So during COVID is when it happened. I mean, during the earlier part of COVID.
Yeah. So I took my oath ceremony while I was at Red Wing Festival. And when I came back, there was a cake made out of Miller Lite that my friends had put together, and red and white and blue banners everywhere. And I was given a Stars and Stripes dungarees to wear. And it really did feel like an incredibly special and emotional moment. Unfortunately, none of my family was able to be there because of the COVID restrictions that were in place. And ultimately, you know, it sort of took some of the funfare out of the ceremony, but ultimately it was an incredible experience. And being able to be both an American citizen and a British citizen, still not having to give up my British citizenship, is a great place to be. I really, really do value the citizenship. And, you know, the process takes a while. You've got to be interviewed. You've got to have background checks. You've got to, you know, show that you're going to be a valid member of society. And that does take a while to go through that process.
Wow. It sounds like it's really worth it, though. And you're enjoying your dual citizenship. You know, that's really great.
Yeah, it's great for when you travel, because you go to the front of the line in both directions.
That's incredible, Benny, right there. For the online business, the baby product business, did you say it was called Parent Baby? Was that the name of it you said?
Yeah, parentbaby.com.
Okay.
I couldn't believe that the domain name was available when I bought it. I was like, this is perfect. Originally it was an eBay store, and then we actually created a full e-commerce website. And a lot of it was just purely automated. It would send an email to the manufacturer and it would go directly to the customer. Some of the larger items, strollers, bounce houses, we had to hold inventory in our house. As you can imagine, a bounce house takes up a lot of room in your dining room. It was a particularly large townhome. But, you know, ultimately the recession came around in 2008 and meant that people cut back on their spending, and we had to sort of take a step back from it and decided to shut the business down and focus on full-time employment with benefits.
Not a bad plan, James. That's not a bad plan at all. I understand that. But imagine you learned a lot from that whole business venture. What would you say is your biggest takeaway lesson from that experience that you feel most influenced what you're doing in your business today?
I think one of the things that I've learned both from that experience and other jobs that I've had is the importance of being able to choose who you work with. And that, especially now with Minerva, we have very specific rules about who we do and we don't work with. Every team member also has the right to refuse to work on a project. And then if that happens, we as an organization need to look inward and decide why it was that we chose that client. So our basic rules are we don't do any projects related to politics, firearms, religion, or cultural appropriation, regardless of the side of the debate that you stand on. And, you know, ultimately, we're just marketing and making websites. We're not brain surgeons or anything like that. We need to enjoy the work that we're doing. And especially during the pandemic, we've all had the opportunity to realize that ultimately a job should be there to support your life. And having a good work-life balance is essential. That's important for staff morale, it's important for retention, and overall as being, you know, a good company to work for.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It sounds like work-life balance is really important to you, and that's a big part of your takeaway lesson from the original business venture that's influencing what you do today.
Absolutely. And especially when you have family as well. You know, I spent many, many hours starting up Minerva, working till 2 o'clock in the morning and missing out on time that I'll never get back. And ultimately you realize that time is precious, and really the only thing you have control over is how you utilize that time. And being able to go to basketball games or cross-country meets or parent-teacher meetings, or be there for a friend's event or that sort of thing is so important, because you know, you only get one shot at this. And so ultimately, you're never going to be wishing that you spent more time at work. And you know, those moments are precious.
So if I'm hearing you right, the investment of time in relationships is much more important than time spent in the business. Not that making money is not important, but that's the balance of work life is what you're sharing. I'm hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the very early lessons that I learned was from one of our first clients, John Mather, Mather Architects. And I asked him for some advice when I was in the early days of Minerva. And his recommendation was that your clients should be your friends. Mm-hmm. And previous to that, I'd always had this impression that, you know, work life should always be two entirely separate things and you should never mix them. And his comment was that ultimately, if you're providing your clients with products that they need and they're happy with it, you should ultimately be able to go out and, you know, have a meal with them or a beer with them. And, you know, that's something that we then, you know, looked at and made sure we included that in our company values, to be able to, you know, say to our clients that, you know, ultimately this is a relationship where we will, you know, provide you with what you need as opposed to things that you don't need and you shouldn't be spending money on. So relationships and fostering those is, you know, is great for both work and for personal life.
Speaking of values for your company, I know the laughers can't see this right now, but is that what's on the wall behind you, the values of your company? Is that what I'm seeing right there?
Yeah, when originally started up Minerva, it was myself and a very talented individual called Ryan Keener. And Ryan actually designed this, but we locked ourselves in a conference room for 2 days and came up with what our goals were as an organization, what our company values were. And there was just one thing that we really couldn't figure out what it was. And that's where the flip-flops comes from. And Ryan had this pair of, I forget if it was Nike or Adidas flip-flops that he always used to wear. And he had them for years. And, you know, eventually there was duct tape on them. to try and keep them together. Nice. And ultimately what we were trying to say was, you know, we don't take ourselves too seriously. Ultimately it's about, you know, having a good time, enjoying ourselves, having a great relationship with our clients. It's not too formal. We couldn't figure out a way of actually saying that. So that's where the flip-flops just comes in there. And, you know, we have other things like quality is greater than quantity, relationships, and what was it? It was no stupid questions. Science equals awesome. And so we sort of came up with all these different things that we wanted to manifest as an organization.
Yeah, that's really great. My mom used to always say when I was growing up that there is no such thing as a stupid question. The only stupid question are the ones never asked. That's what she used to always say to me. Yeah, that always stuck with me. I also see an interesting word there. It says quad. Why quad?
This one here?
Yes.
That's actually quality, but it's cut off.
Oh, well, that explains everything now. I was like, quad? I thought maybe James Madison University tie there because they have the quad. So I got curious. Yeah. So is there a story behind the story? But quality is pretty straightforward. I get that. That's really great. You have an incredible story, and you came here specifically to relocate to the Shenandoah Valley. Why specifically here?
So really, it was about, you know, choosing a place that was affordable, had good schools and low crime, that sort of thing. So did a lot of research. Des Moines, the Triangle down in Raleigh, and even Ithaca. But my great aunt suggested that unless I want to dig out my car every morning in the winter, moving to Ithaca was not a great idea. So we then ended up either Charlottesville or Harrisonburg, and we visited both, and we just felt more at home in Harrisonburg. And it's been our home ever since. It's only 2 hours from Dulles, so it's easy for my family to get into. And funnily enough, we heard a lot about outside the blast zone.
When
we were moving over here, which basically means that if something terrible happens in DC, we should be over here. So it's a rather unusual selling point.
What was that again? So what did you hear about the blast zone again? One more time.
So my understanding is that Harrisonburg is far enough away from DC that if a nuclear bomb was in DC, the electromagnetic pulse would not reach here. And we would be far enough away that it would not cause, you know, you would be okay-ish to then get in your car and run.
I like to know that, and good choice. That's really good. And for lappers out there that may not know where Ithaca is, that's New York, correct? So that's why
I believe that's where Cornell is, right?
I think so.
Andy from the office would be able to tell us.
Yeah. Google that, people. We're going to keep moving on. You had a few jobs in Harrisonburg before you opened up Digital Minerva. Can you tell us a little bit more about the jobs you had?
Yeah. So prior to working over here, I worked in insurance and worked for this great, great company called Advance Insurance and worked with all manner of underwriters. We had, you know, regular car insurance policies all the way through to people who had helicopters to get to work. So it was really exciting, different mix of people at Lloyd's of London and actually speaking to the underwriters there. And then when I moved over to America, I got a job in insurance here, but I really didn't feel like insurance worked the same way over here. I felt it was more a case of they take your premiums and then try and figure out ways not to give you the money back. So I didn't really have a great feeling about it. And I only tried that for like 6 months. And then I had a very brief job working in marketing with the Gravity Group. And that was probably one of the funniest jobs I've ever had. Christian and Steve that were there at the time, we would play games to try and get each other to laugh when you were taking a sip of a drink. They're very funny people. And then I got a job at JMU. And really, it was sort of an entry-level position, updating records and entering gifts. And I one day went to speak with Annie Perrine, who's the director of communications and marketing at JMU. And he gave me advice on classes to take at JMU while I was working. And he said that, you know, in the future, if a position came up, they would consider it. And the webmaster job came up. And my dear friend Lisa Ha recommended I applied for it. And lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, I was the webmaster for JMU. And I got to work with some fantastically talented people. And it was really a baptism of fire. I felt like I knew a decent amount of web development, but JMU has so many different technologies in place, and they were going through a very major content management migration at the time. So I got to be in some, you know, incredible projects and work with really talented people and learn so many things. Unfortunately, there's only so far that you can progress within JMU, and I felt that actually I'd be able to advanced my career by moving outside of JMU into the private sector. And so I worked for an agency for about 5 years after that. And during that time, I sort of figured out what it was that I would want to be, opened an agency, and ultimately then took the jump and opened up Minerva in September of 2018.
That's really incredible, your journey you have there in making the transition to a full service agency is a leap for sure, to go from a salary of benefits to opening up your own business. So what was the turning point for you to say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take on the risk of opening my own company.
Yeah. So especially in America, that's a very daunting prospect of, especially when it comes to health insurance, benefits, retirement, all that sort of thing. It's a very different social safety net over here than what I grew up with. And ultimately, it was about being able to choose who I worked with, who my clients were. I at times was not happy about the work that I was doing, and was not in a position to be able to decide that I don't want to work on this particular project. So Ryan and I both worked together at that agency, and we decided to, Ryan joined a little bit after I left, but ultimately, there was a period where I was working two jobs. I was working on from 6 p.m. until 2 o'clock in the morning, and going home, getting a little bit of sleep, and then going into the office and working for the agency. And ultimately, I needed to get my freelance clients to a place where I was able to, pay the bills and offer employment to other people. And during the initial stages, I reached out to people that I admired and I saw as successful in the local community. And one of those people was Aaron Ludwig from Jack Brown's.
Oh, great.
Spent several hours with me talking about, the challenges that he'd faced starting a business, which is, now an incredibly successful business. And a couple of weeks later, he rang me and said, "We'd like to be a part of your business's portfolio. Can you put together a proposal for me to share with the chief operating officer?" And I did. And they have been our living client. And we are still working with them to this day, every single month. We work with them on their website, their photography, video, training, and print materials. And this weekend, I'm traveling down to Greenville, South Carolina for their latest location opening. So I'm going to be photographing that and creating a virtual tour. But, ultimately getting the business to a place where we had income coming in every single month so that I knew I was going to be able to pay the mortgage. It was ultimately where I got that too, but it took a lot of work and a lot of hours, and I certainly don't want to have to go back to staying up till 2 o'clock in the morning. And ultimately, we're now at a position where that's not something that we have to do.
I think there's a lot of beauty in the story you just shared, and one of the takeaways for me is the beauty in getting wisdom from people that are ahead of you in whatever you want to do. And that mentorship is priceless. And look at what it's been able to do for you and your company. And I don't know Aaron personally, but I have heard wonderful things. We've met, I think, and we know of each other. But I think that's about as far as it is right now. But very inspired to call him for an upcoming podcast guest and just connect with him more as a young entrepreneur myself. Not young person anymore, a newerpreneur, comedypreneur person. So I love that. There's so much that people can do to help one another, whether they're behind or ahead, that can really make a difference in your life. And that's certainly a testimony in your own story of that.
Yeah. And we try to give back as much as we can to the community. We try and balance the work that we do of projects where we make a profit and then projects where we work for nonprofits. Especially during the pandemic, we applied for some grants and we got some grant money through FNM Bank And we worked with our clients who were struggling, who suddenly had no income coming in because everything shut down. And we worked with them to come up with solutions for how they could continue to do business during such a new time. And then, you know, during the year, we'll also work on projects for local charities, because we feel it's important to give back to the community that has provided us with success and the business that we have.
Yeah, that's a great business that you have. Speaking of which, I'm very curious about why you call it Digital Minerva.
That's a great question.
And well, thank you.
Actually, feeds back to your original question about tell me about Bath and where I should go. Minerva is the Roman goddess of strategic arts, warfare, and trade. And Sulis Minerva is the goddess associated with the Roman baths. So we figured that, you know, have your team, strategic warfare, you know, bringing strategy into that, arts, trade, that kind of thing, spoke to sort of the work that we do. But also, Sulis Minerva talks about where I'm originally from and, you know, where I grew up. So Digital Minerva is the name. Most of the time we go by Minerva, but the full name of the company is Digital Minerva.
I love it. There's so many interesting things about you, James Carter, that I want to talk about. And here's another one. You were diagnosed with dyslexia at age 11 and then attended the Dyslexia Institute for 7 years, learning how to surpass this condition. I want to ask first, what was most challenging to you about this journey?
So originally, when I was what we call in junior school, which is up to age 11, in my final parent-teacher class, my teacher told my parents that I was stupid and lazy. Mm. Thankfully, my parents decided to send me to an independent school. And after a couple of weeks of the new semester there, my extra English teacher recommended I go for testing. And sure enough, was confirmed that I had dyslexia. So, you know, you go your whole life not realizing the reason why you can't remember things. And, you know, you act up and you're the class clown to try and put some of the attention away from your weaknesses, mm-hmm. to all of a sudden realizing that actually there's a reason why my brain is this way, and why when I read a page of text and I get to the bottom, I can't remember anything I've read. And so thankfully the regional center for the Dyslexia Institute, which is a national organization, was in my hometown. So every Thursday afternoon I would leave school. The school that I went to, our school days were from 8 a.m. until 8:30 at night. And so in the afternoon on a Thursday, I would go to the Dyslexia Institute, spend a couple of hours there. And we would do things like, you know, I would read into a dictaphone and then I would listen back to my reading and read the text off the page, because we discovered that if I listen and read at the same time, I can retain that information. Thankfully, these universities are able to scan books and turn them into audiobooks. You don't have to actually read it yourself. But really knowing that, you know, there's a reason why I'm different. And it's not because I'm stupid. It's because my brain operates in a different way. And ultimately, most dyslexic people will be able to find something that they're good at and makes sense to them. And it took me until my early 30s, late 20s, to realize that coding made sense to me. I'd always been good at sort of math and physics and those sorts of things, but really struggled with language and art and things that required interpretation. But ultimately, if something's not working, there's a reason it's not working. And being able to find that needle in a haystack, I find incredibly satisfying. And, you know, if it's done correctly, it doesn't work. So it's not a case of you can write an essay and you can phrase it in 100 different ways. it literally has to be a specific way. And so that's what I really enjoy about my job is obviously as I run the company, I spend a lot of my time doing tasks that aren't those sorts of things, you know, the day-to-day running of a business. But when I actually get to really work hands-on on a project, I find it incredibly satisfying. And it's, you know, I'm thankful that I was ultimately able to find what that specific thing was that would work well with my brain.
Yeah, that definitely are things, that's definitely things to be thankful for in that whole journey, is to understand how your brain works and what you can do to actually not only survive, but thrive and flourish with the abilities and talents you've been given. So that is amazing.
Learn to utilize, you know, different tools. Everything I'm going to do is on my GCal. If it's not on there, chances are I'm not going to remember it. So, you know, my day tomorrow is entirely laid out in my Google Calendar, and I looked at it the night before and a few days before so that I know what's upcoming, where I need to be, that sort of thing. So, you know, ultimately you learn how to live with it and adapt and utilize resources to the best that you can.
What would you say is the toughest part about dealing with your dyslexia?
I think one of the strangest things is not knowing what's typical and atypical. Because you go your whole life living the way that you do. And, you know, sometimes you'll realize that something that's incredibly challenging for you is just completely normal and easy for most people. You know, I have immense difficulty retaining what I hear. So, you know, a lot of the time I will use transcribing tools, meetings that will record and then write up text. But really, while in the beginning it was very concerning to know that I had a learning disability, ultimately I was fortunate in that I had access to those resources to be able to learn how to learn differently, to utilize tools and techniques to live as normal a life as possible. And I would say, really, it doesn't impact my work life. It doesn't really impact my personal life, apart from I sent my mum a Christmas gift and I almost wrote happy birthday in the gift notes. And thankfully my girlfriend caught it before I hit send. But my mum would not have been surprised in the slightest had a Christmas gift rolled up with happy birthday written on it.
And still loves you in the present too. You know? You call them mums in England, right? Instead of mom, it's mum, right?
Yeah, it's a U-M, not an O-M.
And that's right. So your mom still loves it. And you. That's awesome. Now, with your digital marketing expertise, let's get back into that. And running your full-service digital agency, I imagine keeping up with new digital trends is paramount to your ongoing success. What are some of the newest digital trends you can share with us that you're aware of?
I think the major shift that I've seen over the last year or two is how content is the primary driver of web presence, marketing, that sort of thing. It used to be that you could, you know, come up with a design, make a pretty website, chuck some words into it, and you were good. Search engines now value quality content so highly that it's really not uncommon for a talented content creator to make more money than a web developer, considerably more money, and understandably so, because what they do shapes the design and it shapes the development. The whole process is almost reversed now, that when we start on a project, we've got to know our clients' messages. We've got to know how that's going to be translated into a design, how it's going to be laid out, where the various different avenues of navigation are, how people are going to consume that content, how often it needs to be created. So really, that's been the major shift that I've seen over the last few years. And ultimately, you know, it's always search engines that tend to drive technology. Mobile friendly websites were really, you know, that was pushed by Google. Dropping flash technology years back was driven by Apple stopping that support on their devices. And so ultimately, you have to respond to the market to be able to deliver the products that clients need and listen to a client and understand what they need versus what they want, because sometimes those two can be different, is a really important step at the beginning of it. But then being able to know what their story is, what their message is, who their audience is, and how that information should be relayed to that audience is of uttermost importance these days.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's a lot of terminology in there, but it brings to mind, maybe not everybody, for example, knows about what SEO means. SEO is search engine optimization, correct?
Correct, yes.
And why is that so important?
So ultimately, when someone is searching for your product, your service, they will use particular search words. So on a Saturday, if I'm looking for, you know, a nice brunch spot, I'll use the phrase brunch near me. And then, you know, hopefully the likes of Magpie and Capital Waffle House and Billy Jack's will then show up in search results because they've done, you know, a good job on providing that information. So what search engine optimization is ultimately creating content so that when a search engine looks at your website, it knows what your services, your products, what your company is all about. And therefore, hopefully moves you up in the rankings within Google and Bing and whatever search engines people choose to use. But it really is sort of a marathon in terms of the work for SEO as opposed to a sprint. If you wanted to do a sprint, that's where paid advertising comes in, which is search engine marketing or SEM. But you know, a lot of businesses will work on SEO because really that gives you long-term gains. And ultimately, not everyone trusts those sponsored ads that show up at the top of a page and would much rather click on a real website as opposed to a paid ad.
Yeah, that's really important. So got to make sure my website pops up when they search best comedy shows near me.
Yeah. And for, it can be more than just your website. It can be your Google My Business listing.
Yeah.
You know, and making sure that you're putting content into Google, making sure that that's kept up to date, as well as other websites linking back to you to give you credibility. So it's really, you know, it's much more than just putting good quality content into your website that's updated in a timely fashion. You really do have to keep tabs on what Google's algorithm is finding most valuable.
Wow. That's a good segue into the next question of my curiosity that is piqued with all of this. I'm reading a lot about AI right now. And to me, it's amazing the direction that's going with the ChatGPT. I think I've got that right, or I'm close. I'm wondering, does AI play any current role in your website development, this SEO, content creation, video marketing, or other digital services that you have to offer? Is it something you're even thinking about?
So we don't utilize AI in house. However, okay, the tools that we utilize, such as Google Ads, Facebook Ads, those sorts of things, I would imagine have machine learning behind their algorithms and how they assess the ads and what quality rankings they provide to them, so that it doesn't require people to be reviewing every single ad that's out there. They have seen and have been targeted with adverts for AI-designed websites. That is a thing. And you know, it may well be in the future that machine learning is to a point that, you know, as a web developer, that job becomes redundant. And ultimately, I see that there is always a need for human interaction. Mm-hmm. And at least for the foreseeable future, and hopefully during my lifetime, that won't cease to be. But ultimately, you know, I may be being naive and look back at this in 10 years' time and think that I was a fool. But really, you know, ultimately being able to sit down with a client and hear their story and learn their goals and be able to translate that into a digital presence, that is, you know, that's something that's learned by being a human.
I agree. I don't think that there is any replacement for the human connection. So our world may indeed look different with the evolution process of AI, but it will not replace the human to human connection. It's just not the same. So I agree with that. So we'll see what happens in 10 years when we have a futuristic conversation in that time period, what has happened. But in the meantime, you keep yourself encouraged and inspired personally with your own creativity. And I'm curious, in what ways do you do that for yourself? What ways do you go about in inspiring your creativity that you find most productive and effective for you?
Yeah, so there's two elements of my job, one of which is coding, and it's very logical and very rules bound. And then, you know, there's another side, which is coming up with solutions and designs and figuring out how to utilize technology to provide a service. And oftentimes I find that I can't sit down and say, I need to be creative now. It doesn't work like that. And ultimately, when it comes to the work that we do as an organization, there are times that we need to be available during the day, but everyone is free to work the hours that they wish to work, because creativity doesn't happen on a 9-to-5. You know, sometimes I'll be taking a shower and suddenly an idea will come into my head, or I'll be out on a bike ride or a run. Particularly, I absolutely adore running. And I find that being able to get out and run and hit the blacktop and just process my thoughts and clear out my brain oftentimes will then lead to the noise disappearing and then being able to think more about the sort of things that I need to do. You know, I know your podcast is about everything apart from hiking, but you know, we live in a beautiful part of the world.
We
and
do.
Getting out walking is, you know, is a wonderful thing to do. And you know, I really find that being able to clear my head either through exercise or breathing or just putting myself in a different environment will often allow my brain to wander and think through things and come up with solutions.
That's really great. Yeah, you know, you did dance on the line there about talking about hiking, but it's also the answer to the question. So I'm going to let that one slide, James Carter.
Okay. I'm not going to get ejected from the meeting.
No, and I'm still going to drop this podcast. So. It's all good. Now, you started Digital Minerva in Harrisonburg, but I also see now you have an office in Charlottesville. When and why did you expand to open a second office there?
So I feel that the two cities are fairly different despite being so close. And I was traveling over here a lot was spending a fair amount of time in Charlottesville during the day. I have some clients over here and in the surrounding areas, and really, you know, started to enjoy the area and felt that, you know, we would probably be a good fit within this community, and found an awesome co-working space on the downtown mall in the Code building, and just really started to, you know, work from here a couple of times a week. We still maintain our address at the depot around the back of the Ice House in Harrisonburg. So we have the two locations, but ultimately it's really me that's going back and forth between the two locations. Everyone else works remotely. We have three people that are based in Virginia, one in New York. And so, you know, ultimately our team is distributed, and that pretty much happened in March of 2020, where we shut down the office and everyone went remote. And then people started to realize that, you know, we do all of this by Zoom, have continued to do so as restrictions have eased up. And really, we can work from wherever there's an internet connection and electricity. And ultimately, that led to, you know, people moving across country and various different parts of Virginia, so that, you know, ultimately they could live the type of lifestyle that they wanted to in the place. But ultimately, I feel Charlottesville has more larger organizations that we would be able to complement their businesses and assist them with their online presence. So it seemed like a natural progression to be able to then move into the Charlottesville area.
Yeah, I think that's really exciting, James, that your business continues to expand and grow and adapt with the changing times. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing what's next for you and your company. And I'm very thankful to know you. I think more people should and get in touch with you and see what, you know, you and your team could do for them. So let's ask this next question, which is, how best can people follow you on social media or otherwise to connect with you and your company?
Yeah, our primary presence is on Instagram, and that's digital_Minerva. And on there, you can see some of the things that we're up to, some of the lighter-hearted moments of our company. So that's going to be your best bet. And check us out.
All right. And do you have a website also, I imagine?
Yes, digitalminerva.com. That's digitalminerva.com.
Laughers, little side note. Did you hear that? He also does some voiceover. And you could tell from that little bit right there. So just as an aside, another reason to get in touch with James, if you need a Brit voice and you want a wonderful person to do it for you, there's another reason 1000 to get in touch with James Carter. And we'll put all that information in the show notes for you as well, so you can get in touch with him. And thank you so much, James. This has been super fun hanging out with you today, hearing more about your story and learning about all things Digital Minerva. Thanks again for coming on the show. This has been so lovely and so, so much fun. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, never a chore, Dawn.
Thanks so much, James. And laughers, to get in touch with James or work with this team that brings together their creative, strategic, and knowledge-based resources to create exciting and meaningful web-based experiences, visit digitalminerva.com. That's digital, MINERVA.com. We'll be sure again to put this website in our show notes for you as well. And of course, lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to an X2 Comedy show or let us bring a show to you. To find out more, head to x2comedy.com. Be sure to share us with a friend. Until next time, cheers.